I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. In the days before Christmas, 1943, a B-24 launched from Alaska's Ladd Field crashed in the Arctic, killing four of the five men on board. The lone survivor, pilot Leon Crane, kept himself alive for almost 12 weeks in the harsh Yukon winter. 81 Days Below Zero tells Leon Crane's story for the first time. Author and journalist Brian Murphy joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mindy.
So Leon Crane's story of surviving in the Arctic winter after a plane crash is pretty remarkable. So when did you and how did you come across the story?
Very indirectly. Back in 2007, I was covering Iraq at the time and was getting deluged by Pentagon press releases. And of course, I'd read the ones that had to do with my beat and the Iraq conflict and so forth. And oddly, one other one caught my eye. It was about the burial of a pilot at Arlington National Cemetery, 2007, and it was the pilot of the plane you described. The person in my book was the co-pilot. So I read, it said World War II Alaska, kind of intriguing, and the very last paragraph of this press release said Lieutenant Hoskins, the guy who was buried, was among four people who perished in this plane crash, and one happened to survive and walk out of the Arctic after nearly 3 months.
Like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
So give us a little background on why the U.S. had a military presence in Alaska and describe the flight missions out of Ladd Air Force Base.
Okay, well, Alaska was an interesting side to World War II that a lot of people maybe are vaguely aware of, but there's much more to learn. Essentially, there were two roles in Alaska. One was as a back channel to send warplanes and supplies to the Soviet Union, which, of course, were allies of the U.S. at the time. So a lot of planes, more than 8,000 planes, crossed over the Bering Strait from Alaska. The Russian pilots would come over, pick them up at Ladd Field, which is outside Fairbanks, and fly them back to Russia, and then they'd head off to the Eastern Front or wherever they needed them. A secondary role in Alaska was what the pilot I wrote about was involved with. They were doing a lot of cold weather testing on aircraft. The worry was that the next war front could be North Atlantic, Norway, something like that. So they were sending these planes up in super cold conditions. And a lot of them were not faring so well. I mean, they were cranked out of factories all over the states, purpose built, and they weren't really equipped for this kind of extreme conditions. And the plane that my guy was on was a example of that.
So the B-24 has been described as the workhorse of the Air Force, but others claim it had been rushed into service because of the war. And you're saying that we're cranking these out. So what were some of the quirks of the B-24?
Well, some of the quirks were the hydraulics were always considered kind of sketchy, which, of course, in cold weather, that adds to the problems. Like any warplane, they had very poor heating. The electrical system sometimes was malfunctioning. But probably the thing that is most distinctive about the B-24 as opposed to the B-17, which is its cousin, I guess you'd call it, is that the pilots describe it was not an easy plane to fly. You really had to sort of muscle it through the air. It wasn't a graceful plane, but it was only built for one purpose, and that was to fly over a target and drop bombs. Yeah. So the pilots that I interviewed, they don't speak with a lot of affection about flying it. They have kind of this grudging respect for the plane and that it accomplished its mission, but it wasn't an easy plane to fly.
So tell us about the other members of the crew. Who was on board?
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, the pilot was a guy from Maine who he went down with the plane. And I think for all his life, the pilot I wrote about was haunted by the fact he didn't do more to sort of drag him out of the cockpit. There were three other crew members, a radio operator, someone who was an expert in the kind of instrument dictation of the plane, who was there to work on the tests they were doing, the cold weather testing, and a fifth member of the crew. One of the crew members managed to bail out before my pilot did, or the pilot I wrote about did, and he certainly perished almost instantly because he didn't have on the down flight suit. He had on a plug-in suit that works great when it's plugged in, like an electric blanket in a way. When it's unplugged, it's a fleece at best. So it was minus 70 when he bailed out, and you know, his body was never recovered, but the chance of survival was nil.
Right. So the mission then was to just test the different instrumentation and things in this cold weather.
Well, they had one specific mission, which was something called prop feathering. And this is shutting down one of the props. They have four props in this plane, and adjusting the blade so it's in its most aerodynamic position. Kind of, I described it as when you put your hand out of a moving car,
right,
and a flat palm, you know, there's a lot of wind resistance and you turn it and you get more aerodynamic. So they were doing that. And the reason for this plane crash is a little unclear, or very unclear, I guess. But most likely it was a stall. They were trying to climb up to 25,000 feet in a tight circle. One of the engines was down, and I think their airspeed was too low, and they went into a spin that they couldn't pull out of.
Mm. So nowadays, the Air Force knows exactly where aircraft are at all times, and there are black boxes recording data about the flights and cockpit conversations. But during World War II, the Air Force relied on the aircraft to radio their location back to the base periodically, and they did not have data recorders. So when Leon Crane's plane failed to return to the base, did the Air Force have any idea where it might be?
Not a clue.
Not a clue.
They knew it was in Alaska. I guess you could probably say that, but... the protocol was to radio in at least once every half hour. And for some reason that we'll never know, the call wasn't made, let's say, 15 or 20 minutes before the crash, which meant they hadn't radioed in their position for probably close to an hour.
It's like finding a needle in a haystack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there was they didn't really have a flight plan. They were said to go up and kind of fly around and find the best, clearest conditions for their testing. So they didn't have a clue, and the search missions probably didn't come within 60 miles of the crash site.
Why do you think Leon Crane was able to survive the crash while the others perished?
Boy, this is something that I still think about a lot, even with the book done. Of course, there was a tremendous amount of luck, like any survival story. A fortune was smiling on him, and that was an important factor. But I think one of the things that differentiated his survival from not being able to handle it, or probably any situation like this, is he was a very methodical, problem-solving thinker. Mm. He didn't panic. I mean, there were moments of panic, obviously, but he was able to sort of deconstruct his situation, deal with what needed to be dealt with. He was an engineer by training, and I think his disposition really helped him a great deal, because if he would have panicked even those first moments, it could have been the end. Yeah. He realized that, for example, there were a lot of boulders and rocks covered by snow. And he took a few steps and quickly realized that if he tried to even walk a little while, he might twist an ankle or break an ankle, and that would be the end, too. So he was very methodical thinker, which I think helped him a great deal.
Describe typical weather conditions in the Arctic in December.
Wow. Okay, so...
It's cold.
It's cold. Definitely cold. To start with, there's about 4 hours of daylight. He went down on the shortest day of the year, December 21st. So very little daylight. The temperatures fluctuated from close to minus 60 to maybe minus 30 during the day. What is helpful for him anyway was that in this area there isn't a lot of wind, which and Fairbanks typically doesn't get a lot of wind either. So there wasn't a tremendous amount of wind chill, but of course at those temperatures it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's not survivable conditions.
Describe the crash site in terms of location to the nearest town or settlement.
Well, the crash site, and interestingly enough, he didn't even know where he was. They knew they were south of the Yukon River. So the Yukon River effectively runs through the center of Alaska. They were about 100 miles, 110 miles south of the Yukon River. The nearest town was probably 70 or 80 miles away. And knowing he didn't know where he was, but the fact that he knew he was south of the Yukon River was an important element because he knew the rivers flowed north. So at least that gave him an orientation that once he decided to walk out, he followed a frozen river. And he didn't know how far the Yukon was, but he knew that it would eventually lead to the bigger river, and bigger rivers lead to settlements.
In some ways, it's probably a good thing he didn't know how far away he was.
Maybe so. Yeah, exactly.
That might have set some panic in.
Yeah, right.
And you, as you said, he was lucky on a number of fronts following the crash. First, he had a package of matches in his pocket that was really by chance because he wasn't a smoker.
Yeah, amazing. And again, it shows how anyone's life can pivot on something that might seem inconsequential at the time. The pilot was a pipe smoker, and he was always forgetting his lighter. His sort of what was sort of known about him is he was always bumming a light and
so
things.
He had
that light. So, on really a spur of the moment decision, as he was gulping down some coffee and rushing over to the hangar that morning, Leon Crane grabbed two packs of matches, and that proved the whole story unfolded from there. He wouldn't have survived without those matches.
Yeah, he also had the letter from his father in his jacket.
Again, another stroke of luck.
And another bit of luck, he was outfitted in gear that gave him a fighting chance. So describe what he was wearing.
Okay, this was not dissimilar to what pilots wear now, maybe a little more rudimentary, but it's a down flight suit that was designed by Eddie Bauer. They had a war contract at the time. And so these were the sort of first down gear that was given to pilots. And it was a overalls, down overalls, and a parka over that, and then a fur-lined hood. So again, there wasn't anything special to it other than the fact that the Air Force at this time was realizing that down was such a better insulator than the wool and leather they had before. So this was the early days of a transition to a different type of flight suit.
He was also fortunate that the crash site was not too far from a river, so he had drinking water. It's not frozen anyway. Describe his first 9 days out in the bush.
Well, his first 9 days were, again, a test of his mental stamina, but also, you know, his quick learning curve on what it's like to be out in weather conditions that can, you know, kill you in a matter of minutes. Having the matches, he quickly realized, of course, fire was a necessity. So because of the spring floods in that part of Alaska, there's lots of driftwood. And because it's super cold, the wood is very desiccated. It's easy to light. So he built a fire, kept that going for 9 days. He pulled branches from the fir trees and kind of built a mattress to insulate himself. But effectively, he was sitting there waiting for a rescue that would never come and tending the fire and looking up on this hillside where the crash site of the plane was, but he couldn't reach it because he was too worried about twisting an ankle or some kind of problem walking through the snow.
So the Air Force had conducted some search missions for the downed plane, but they came up empty, as we said, like finding a needle in a haystack. So when do you think Crane realized that help was probably not coming for him?
Oh, after about 4 or 5 days. At this time in the war, of course, the search missions were not conducted open-ended. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, a few days. And especially in winter conditions in Alaska, the idea that someone could survive was very small. So I think after about day two or three, he realized no one was coming. And this is when he started to formulate the plan that he probably would have to walk out.
Yeah. We're talking with Brian Murphy. His book is 81 Days Below Zero, the incredible survival story of a World War II pilot in Alaska's frozen wilderness. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Brian Murphy. His book is 81 Days Below Zero. On December 29th, 8 days after his plane went down, Leon Crane's parents in Philadelphia received that dreaded Western Union telegram. Not that Leon was dead, but that his plane had been missing since the 21st. Leon knew his parents would receive this news. How did that knowledge impact him?
Yeah, this again was a motivator, of course, but also I think was something that kind of eroded his resolve too, because he, you know, especially in this age where we can text and you feel connected all the time, he was literally assigned to the roles of the dead. They no one expected that he would survive this crash. The Western Union telegram, as you mentioned, didn't explicitly say that he was dead, but the implication was strong. So he knew that everyone was mourning him, and he had no way to reach out to him. So again, this was a huge motivator. But I think in some ways, there were moments when he felt like, well, I should just give up because I'm considered dead already. And those were brief, but they did occur.
Yeah. We're talking about the connectedness we have now. In the introduction to the book, you talk about this kind of isolation, and not the isolation where I'm sitting on a beach somewhere by myself, the isolation that he felt. And that really spoke to you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's something that's, you know, it's hard to grasp in the context of our world. You know, I one of the things that I hope to do someday is walk the Appalachian Trail, personal goal of mine. So I read a lot about it, but even that type of solitude, you read people are texting and they're blogging along the way. So the idea that you can be somewhere where you're unreachable and can't reach out as well. I mean, there are places now, but he was experiencing something that I think very few of us can experience now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Leon Crane was reticent to talk about his 81 days in the wilderness, and he rarely spoke of it. But your book taps into Crane's emotional state and even his inner dialogue during this time in the wilderness. How did you construct that narrative?
Leon had died before I was able to start on this project. His family, though, was very helpful. They gave me access to his personal papers. He did some audio oral histories. Mm-hmm. And talking with some of the people who he served with, obviously his family had great insights, and the military debriefs as well, which was an important thing because they, you know, I'm sure they believed him, but, you know, there's a lot of protocol. Yeah. And once he came back, they had him go through everything step by step. So as best I could, I think I was able to recreate through his own words, but also the portrait of him from the people who knew him well.
Another bit of luck following the crash was 9 days later, he stumbles across an abandoned cabin. He believes the cabin indicates civilization is close by. He spends the night at the cabin. In the morning, he drinks some hot cocoa, puts some raisins in his pockets, and sets off to find this nearby civilization. What happens next?
Well, again, and what's interesting here is he is a kid from Philadelphia, West Philadelphia. He had, the wilderness to him was, you know, super alien. So his idea was, wow, I found this abandoned cabin. It must be effectively like the suburb of a village. You know, there can't be a cabin that's just alone. And so he took off walking up the river with, as you said, a pocket full of raisins and thinking that around the next bend would be a village. And this proved almost fatal. He walked for 12 hours out and realized that there was nothing there, and he had to make a very important decision whether to press on or head back to the cabin, and he headed back.
Yeah. What a difficult decision to make. Civilization could be just around that next bend, could be 20, 30 miles away, but turning around was in some ways admitting defeat.
Certainly, yeah. And I think this was, you know, there were highs and lows for him during this 81 days alone, and I think this was one of the, if not the low point, certainly one of the ones that was most difficult for him to cope with, because his hopes were so high that he was rescued, and they were dashed when he came across nothing. And to retreat was, again, as you said, a mission of defeat.
He does make it back to the cabin, and after looking around inside, he finds food, supplies. What was a cabin doing out in the middle of the Arctic wilderness, and what was it stocked with?
Well, it was there as a trapper's outpost for the spring and fall and summer. It was built by one of these kind of classic Alaskan larger-than-life personalities. It was a guy who's was a trapper. He was a miner. He was a gold hunter. You know, one of these kind of
outdoor rugged types.
Outdoor rugged types, exactly. And so he had built this, as you mentioned, near nothing else, and he would spend. He would head there in the spring when the floodwaters receded, and it was stocked with, in the tradition of Alaska, but also I think in other remote places, you leave a cabin with provisions in case someone in need comes by. So it had food, canned food. It had some tools. It had a 22 caliber rifle, which was a huge thing later, because he was able to hunt some game. But one of the things in the cabin that was really important is it had candles, which, of course, that would probably be part of any supply kit. But Leon Crane, his hands were almost at irreversible frostbite. And he came up with this incredibly elegant solution where he melted the candle wax over his hands and to seal them. And this proved, as you talk to experts in frostbite, this was a really good way to keep his hands from getting any worse.
Yeah, another indication of that analytical mind
that he had.
Really amazing. After getting his strength back, Leon realizes that if he's going to survive, he has to leave the safety and comfort of the cabin to seek civilization. That must have been a really difficult decision. You know, the cabin has food and warmth. Beyond that, he has no idea how close or far away help is. How does he prepare for this journey?
Well, again, as you mentioned, the analytical side of this pilot comes into play here as well. He hears the river ice breaking up a little bit, and the temperature was pushing towards zero, which is
a
still
warm
super
spell,
cold,
yeah.
Warm spell. But even that shift in temperature meant the river ice was shifting. And he looked ahead and said, well, I could wait here until spring, but spring might even be worse. The flood waters might come. They could inundate the cabin. Might be even harder to get out when things are wet and kind of fluid in springtime. So he took some of the cabin, took apart a window and some of the lumber around the cabin, and built a sled that he rigged up with a harness, a human harness, and piled it with as much supplies as he could, and then started to just walk out along this frozen river, heading north, but not knowing how far the Yukon River was.
Mm. So he's got this sled that he's pulling along. He's going on the ice relatively easy, but there are instances when he has to walk through deep drifts of snow. The irony is that he had snowshoes, but he didn't understand how to use them. It's kind of funny when you think of, I mean, he's like MacGyver and everything else.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, again, this is his Philadelphia side showing up. He didn't know how to put them on, and they were really easy to put on when someone showed him later, but he couldn't figure it out.
How far did he typically walk in a day, and what were the conditions like at this point?
He was walking maybe 4 or 5 miles a day, making very slow but steady progress. Part of the complications was the sled. Being an engineer, I found this kind of interesting because he was great at aviation, but maybe not so good at building sleds because it was very hard to pull. It kept getting gummed up in the snow and so forth. But there were times, and you'd think that in these super cold conditions, the ice would be,
thicker,
concrete almost, unbreakable. But during fast-flowing parts of the river, it's pretty thin, and he broke through and fell in a couple times.
Yeah. So what happens when he's, all wet, and how does he recover from that?
Well, he, and this might have been from some of the Air Force training that, because they gave them some very cursory training in survival. But when he fell in, he knew he immediately had to get his clothes off. Mm-hmm. So he, in these incredibly frigid conditions, stripped naked, got a fire going, sort of made a makeshift tent, and would have to sort of huddle naked in next to this fire as his clothes dried and so forth. But that's the only way. Leaving the clothes on
was
dead.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, anybody who's walked through some of those, big drifts of snow, walking, in your backyard, it's so draining. It's like hard to imagine where he got all this energy to keep pushing forward.
It's a remarkable. I mean, I live in Washington now, and last winter I was walking to work, and I'm like, oh, this is horrible. I think that, again, if there's anything that stands out for me in this story beyond just the remarkable ability and the resolve was his mental stamina, which I think is the swing factor.
Yeah. In early March, he encounters a fierce storm, and instead of hunkering down and waiting, he pushes on. You write, quote, he was dangerously close to recklessness. Describe his state of mind at this point.
Well, I think at this point, the idea that the self-doubt was setting in because he, didn't know where the Yukon was. The landscape in this part of Alaska is very uniform. So it's not like if you're heading towards the Yukon, the hills would look different or the terrain would look different. So he had this kind of monotonous day after day trek through these low-lying snow-covered hills. And I think at this point he was getting a little panicky. His supplies were very low. He only had a limited supplies of bullets for the gun. So he was, I think, coming to the point where he knew he had to make a all or nothing push.
Yeah. Kind of like, if I stop, maybe I won't be able to get going again. Right. So after the storm, he realizes he can no longer pull the sled. Again, it's a gamble. He can only carry about a month's worth of food. Did he base this decision on any kind of knowledge or intuition, or do you think he was just following his gut?
I think he was following his gut because he couldn't have known where he was. Mm-hmm. There was no, no markers in the terrain. The topography was not that much different. So I think he was, rolling the dice in the sense that he he knew that his supplies were limited. So as his energy was still, you know, at a level he could keep moving, I think this was the motivation.
And of course, we know that he eventually makes it out. We don't want to give away all the details of when and how that happens. But what was the reaction from the Air Force and his family?
There's a great this comes from the military debriefs, the military records. So he was again, after he found and he was brought to an airstrip. And at this time, he met the guy whose cabin saved his life. So he had this encounter with this guy. And as he was flying back to Ladd Field, the pilot radios to the tower saying, "We have Leon Crane in the cabin." And they radio back saying, "Is he alive or dead?" They thought they would bring back a body.
Yeah, amazing. And there's actually a photograph of him in front of that cabin.
Yeah, and he looks okay.
Yeah,
it's remarkable. I mean, his clothes are a little torn, and he has a beard, and he looks like he's been through an ordeal, but certainly not. He doesn't have that kind of gauntness.
Yeah, well, even the expression on his face is like, it looks like he's, on a hunting vacation
exactly.
Or something. It's pretty amazing.
Again, yeah, I mean, I think part of it is he was 23 years old, too, right. So
yeah,
at the peak form. But yeah, I mean, I think this was one of the things that everyone comments on, the way he was able to keep himself alive, but also in reasonably good shape.
And so obviously there was a camera in this cabin.
So, yeah.
I mean, I wonder how he had that thought to take the photo. You know?
Well, it wasn't him. It was the family. Because once again, they kind of didn't believe it.
Right.
They're saying, you walked for, 81 days. And, when he described the crash site, they knew the cabin,
right.
The guy's cabin. So they fully appreciated what he went through and the distance and so forth. And in fact, one of the family members who found him said, "Okay, when you shave, though, at least leave a mustache, because you'll look too clean cut. It'll be too hard for people to believe." So he left a mustache.
That's funny. We're talking with Brian Murphy. His book is 81 Days Below Zero: The Incredible Survival Story of a World War II Pilot in Alaska's Frozen Wilderness. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Brian Murphy. His book is 81 Days Below Zero, The Incredible Survival Story of a World War II Pilot in Alaska's Frozen Wilderness. What's interesting, too, is when the Air Force, has their whole process with him. They take his weight and his health, and his weight is pretty much the same as it was.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I think that I interviewed doctors and other people who are involved in extreme survival conditions and so forth. And it does happen. Some people have the sort of physique that they can handle this. Other people don't.
Yeah.
And he was just fortunate.
He was young. But I mean, and surprising that his health was so good. I mean, after a trek like that. So what does he do after the Air Force?
Well, he served about another year. He met his future wife,
Wilma.
Interestingly enough, as he was getting some medical care. And they both left the Air Force about a year later. And then he went into aeronautics. He was worked at Sikorsky and other places. But interestingly enough, and very much like many people of his generation, World War II veterans, he didn't talk about this experience very much. And this was one of the difficulties to try to piece it together through his family.
Mm-hmm.
The records were all there, but his family knew just the broad strokes of this story.
Yeah, so surprising to them, I'm sure, when they learn more about what he actually went through. So do you have any clues as to why he was reticent to discuss it?
You know, I think there was just this kind of taboo, I think, of being self-promotion, talking about a personal experience, his own taboo, of course. Like, but I also think, as I mentioned earlier, I think he was bothered and haunted all his life by the fact that he left the cockpit without forcing the pilot out, because they, as this plane was in a spin, they were both doing the same thing. They had to pull out their parachutes. They had to buckle them up. They realized the plane was it couldn't be recovered. That we couldn't pull it out of the spin. And I think this bothered him all his life.
Survivor's guilt.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. Also, too, he mentions the fact that people went through much worse than he did. So in his eyes, he didn't see this as any kind of heroism or anything. It was because other people had much worse stories to tell.
Well, that's true. And you know, in context, of course, there were people held in prison camps and went through ordeals that, you know, you could say would be much harsher. Yet, whenever he mentioned this, I mean, people obviously were very fascinated by his trek through the wilderness. And the only time he ever really cracked this facade was for the son of a friend he served with in Alaska. Mm. He was doing a school project back, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. And so he gave some video
like the oral history
recollections. But even there, the student was asking him what Alaska was like, and he'd say cold or whatever. Yeah. So he wasn't very forthcoming even with that.
It was interesting, too, because you would think, okay, maybe publicly he wouldn't want to speak about this, but certainly he would tell Wilma. But even after his death, Wilma didn't have much to add.
No, they didn't. The family. And in fact, he kept this so private that he was from Philadelphia, as I mentioned, and he lived in the suburbs of Philadelphia when he died. His obituaries, the Philadelphia media, it was never mentioned. Mm. And it was, you know, this is a type of story, of course, that people would have, journalists would have written about.
Sure, but they knew about
it,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But he kept it that private that even his obituary, even his family, it was very simple. Mm. And they didn't mention his time in Alaska even.
The aircraft was recovered. Was analysis done on the aircraft to determine what caused the crash?
There wasn't, with the wreckage now, there wasn't really the ability to figure out what caused it. As I mentioned, the best guess is that it was a stall. But part of this book, and I think an interesting side of it as well, is the efforts by a park ranger. This crash site is now in a federal wilderness preserve. And the work by a park ranger to visit the site, and his work eventually led to the recovery of the remains of the pilot. And that's what, of course, led to the burial in 2007 and led to me even finding out about the story.
Yeah. I imagine the Air Force records were really interesting, as they, you know, wanting to know every step, where were you, what did you do? That must have been very helpful information.
Exactly. Yeah. And a book like this, or any book about military affairs, is really helped by the meticulous record keeping of the military. First of all, they debriefed him like crazy. And then also, I think as part of a kind of wartime propaganda, they had him do an interview with a magazine that's no longer around, but it's called American Magazine. And they put some, at the time, were like celebrity journalists on this interview. They interviewed him for hours and hours. Only a portion of it was used in the article, but very lucky for me, his family somehow had the original transcript. So I had this typewritten transcript from 1943.
Wow. Also, when he meets with, is it the family of the pilot, and he's kind of defensive. when they're talking to him. Like, they wanted to know what happened, and he
exactly.
He was
and
very
I think
defensive.
What you mentioned earlier, yeah. that this is the survivor's guilt, and they yeah. were taken aback. This is the if you'd think you'd talk about it with anyone, it would be the brother and his wife yeah. Of the pilot, and he. Once again, said very little, and this has troubled them. And when I interviewed them decades later, they were very troubled by the fact that he, they feel he kept important details to himself.
Do you believe that, or do you think it was just he had just the guilt that the survivor's guilt that was bothering?
I think that's right. I think it's the guilt, and the one thing he did. Mentioned to his family, and this is why I kind of go along with this line of thinking, is he would often talk about saying, gosh, I should have just grabbed him by the parka, or just I should have pushed him out. I was the co-pilot. He was the pilot. Why did I go first? And I think this again just was aided him for the rest of his life.
Leon's children eventually travel to Alaska to learn more. In fact, they retrace his route from the crash site. What did they say about that?
For them, it was a very profound trip. They visited the cabin that saved his life. It's not a functioning cabin now, but there's remnants of it. And to them, it was like their own personal archaeology of their dad. They were to see the things and to walk the same ground that their father did in this, you know, the time of his life that he didn't share that mm-hmm. much. So this was to them opened up windows and actually a huge interest in their father's story as well.
Yeah, I can imagine just not hearing just little details of it, but then to actually see it and walk some of that route and just think how alone he was and pretty much everybody had given up on finding him. That's pretty powerful.
Oh yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean I during some research trips there, I flew over the site. It was winter. I wanted to go and experience the cold, which is very cold. Just being out there, you look and it's this everywhere you look, north, south, east, west is just wilderness. And then to look down from the plane and think like there was this small dot that would represent him in this huge expanse was really powerful.
Yeah. And to think, just where his frame of mind was through all of this, you think the realization, nobody's coming for me. Then like civilization, I don't know where it is. And I'm going and going and going. It's absolutely remarkable that he made it through that.
And I think one of the things, too, that differentiates this story from maybe others, or at least I found interesting, was in many Arctic and Antarctic survival stories. I mean, these are explorers. Mm-hmm. These are people who were there willingly, or even
they know the conditions.
They knew the conditions. They knew they were getting into. This guy, literally dropped from the sky, mm-hmm. and he had to learn a whole new way of survival, learn a whole new way of thinking, and he managed to do it. It's kind of remarkable.
As you're going through the research and putting this book together, I'm just thinking some of the things that would strike me is the luck. The finding the cabin, having the matches, the dad's letter, the parka. I mean, this seems like one lucky guy, along with, having that analytical brain. As you went through this, what stood out for you in this story?
Well, I think you really summarized it well. To me, the luck is so important and so powerful because first of all, the fact that he was doing a good deed for someone else, even a small one, but mm-hmm. grabbing the matches, the fact that it was kind of almost cosmic
yeah.
payback
yeah,
right, in a way. Yeah. Again, without this letter from his dad, that he was able to use to start the fire. Without the matches, there wouldn't be a book, and there wouldn't have been anything. He would have perished probably that first day or the next day. So, again, I constantly now are more oriented thinking like, you know, some small thing that you do could have, you know, huge consequences down the road.
And just finally thinking of his parents, you know, the Western Union telegram, it's not saying he's dead, but pretty much that's what they're indicating. So then for him to come home, but you mentioned the numbers of missing in action and all those families who had that same thing. Is he going to walk through the door someday?
Right.
Which was true for some of the other families of the rest of the crew who died in that. Did they make it through? And, you know, until you find the bodies, you just don't know.
Exactly. And, you know, even the fact that the pilot, you know, clearly didn't survive, but the fact that his remains weren't found until 2007, even those decades later, provided important closure for his own family. They, you know, you'd think after all these years, they would have been absorbed into, you know, everything they do and their thinking, but it just shows that stories unfinished are really never finished for families and loved ones.
Yeah. And I just can't even imagine those parents watching, you know, their son walk through that door, you know, thinking he was never coming home.
Yeah, again. And when he called his dad from the base, and he's just this almost chilling. He's like, "Dad, it's Leon." He says over the phone from Alaska, and I just can imagine what his dad was thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, this was like a call from the beyond.
Right. It should have been, "Are you sitting down?"
Yeah,
before
exactly.
It's Dad, it's Leon. Well, the book is 81 Days Below Zero, The Incredible Survival Story of a World War II Pilot in Alaska's Frozen Wilderness. Brian Murphy, thanks so much for coming in and sharing the story with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Mindy. Thanks.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.